From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the cost of question one in Massachusetts. It would limit the number of patients assigned to nurses. But a new study says it would cost the state almost $1 billion a year, giving ammunition to opponents of the measure.
We're going to lose 1,000 behavioral health beds. We're going to have units that aren't going to open. So frankly, community hospitals are going to close.
But backers of question one challenge the study and say it will improve patient care. Also today, Brett Kavanaugh and the blackout theory.
I've never blacked out. That's the allegation. That's wrong.
Why some people can't remember things after drinking too much. Plus, manager Alex Cora and the Red Sox get ready for the postseason playoffs, which get underway Friday night at Fenway Park.
I love it. I love it here. The atmosphere, you know, it should be loud and fun.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with the potential cost of a ballot question that has Massachusetts voters closely divided. Question one would set limits on the numbers of patients assigned to nurses at hospitals and other healthcare facilities across the state. Advocates, including some nurses, community groups, and a long list of elected officials, say the measure would improve patient care. Now comes a study from the independent Massachusetts Health Policy Commission. It concludes that if question one were to pass, hospitals would have to hire as many as 3,000 additional nurses, and the cost, it could run as high as $950 million a year. That's almost $1 billion if you're keeping score at home. WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg has been looking at the study and was at the Health Policy Commission today, and she's with us now. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Anthony.
So let's dig into that $950 million figure a bit more. How did the commission come up with that number?
Okay, so first of all, the $950 million is the high end of a range. They're saying it could cost between $676 and $949 million. That's a big contrast to what the proponents of the ballot measure were estimating, which was more like between $35 and $47 million
a
year.
Yeah, that's a big contrast.
Yes, and it's quite a hefty sum, even when you put it in the context of Massachusetts having some of the most expensive healthcare on earth already, which, by the way, is why we have this Health Policy Commission as a watchdog on health costs in the first place. Now, David Auerbach, who's the Director for Research and Cost Trends at the Commission, estimates that the costs could amount to just over 1% of total healthcare spending in the state.
All right. Now, 1% doesn't sound like a lot?
It doesn't, but it's 1% or maybe a little closer to 2% of a lot of $61 billion. Or as Auerbach said, understatedly, I would say that is a substantial amount. And it's up to 3.5% of total hospital spending.
All right. So what does that consist of, all that spending?
Right. So it's several elements. So as you said, hospitals would have to hire a couple 3,000 more registered nurses. The pay for nurses would likely go up because that's basic economics, right? There would be more demand for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if a similar law in California is any indication, nurses' income might go up by an average of maybe like 4% or so. And it would cost money to have this new staffing ratio system in place in hospitals. And then there would be some one-time costs, like it could cost millions to put in like a tool to help assess how sick patients are and therefore what the nurse ratio should be for a given unit.
All right. So what does the report say about the impact of question one beyond the higher spending? For example, what does it say about patient safety? Because that's a big argument for those in favor of the question, right?
Yes, yes, it is. So the Health Policy Commission heard today from Dr. Joanne Spetz. She's a University of California, San Francisco expert on healthcare workforce issues. And she says that the research literature generally shows that, as you'd expect, more nurses mean better care. But then there are a lot of devils in the details here. So that California law that's similar to this Massachusetts measure that we're now considering, it passed in 99, came into effect in 2004. And she says thus far, the studies are kind of a wash. She says it's very hard to conclude that the California law systematically improved the quality of patient care.
Huh. So that's surprising. And are there any cost savings projected?
So, yeah, the commission estimates that between $34 and $47 million a year could be saved because hospital stays could be shorter and there might be fewer adverse events, you know, like medical errors, patients who needed help and couldn't get it. And also there could be less turnover of RNs and they could be injured less often.
All right. Now, Carrie, even before the commission released its report, the lead advocacy group for Question One, the Committee to Ensure Safe Patient Care, criticized the analysis. What are they saying now that the report is out?
Well, they're challenging the numbers and they're also questioning why the Health Policy Commission would undertake this analysis when it doesn't analyze every single healthcare bill that goes through the legislature. In a statement, they're calling this analysis a guess on costs, and they're calling it irresponsible and inconsistent and resembles nothing like the commission has done before. Here's Julie Pinkham. She's the executive director of the Massachusetts Nurses Association, which supports Question One. She says the ballot measure all boils down to patients feeling safe when they enter a hospital.
The one thing that this does different is it really, for the first time, gives a vote to people and puts them in control of healthcare and says you do matter and you will have now some control. It's one measure that says it's not going to be secret sauce anymore, folks. When you go in the hospital, you'll know how many patients that nurse is supposed to have and what your level of expectation should be.
All right, Carrie, so what about opponents to Question One? The Coalition to Protect Patient Safety is the main group that opposes it. What are they saying?
So I spoke with Dan Sensi. He's a spokesman for the Coalition to Protect Patient Safety. That is the hospital group opposing the ballot question. He says hospitals may have to make some difficult decisions if the measure passes.
The way that this real rigid ballot question is written, they're not going to have a lot of decisions to make other than cut from places that they can and put nurses where they have to. We're going to lose 1,000 behavioral health beds. We're going to have units that aren't going to open. So frankly, community hospitals are going to close.
So dire predictions. And his takeaways from the commission report are that it says the measure would not improve patient care. And he thinks it takes the California comparison off the table. Though personally, I have a feeling there's still going to be a lot more talk about California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Carrie, both sides of this debate have been making claims about what this question would do. Voters are closely divided, if polls are any indication. Does today's report help bring some clarity to this debate over this ballot question?
Well, I think it begins to bring at least more clarity about some issues. It at least gives us some numbers that we can hang our hats on as we debate this question in the run-up to the November ballot. And, you know, Anthony, my sense is that a lot of people are feeling very confused about this issue. We've got TV ads dueling with each other, lots of money being spent on both sides of the campaign. The pro side has spent nearly $5 million,
wow,
and the anti side has spent more than $9 million. And I do think it's worth remembering that this is what the Health Policy Commission is supposed to be doing, analyzing and assessing what the health cost impact of things are going to be.
Right. And ultimately, it's still going to be up to the voters to decide. Are you seeing any initial response to this analysis?
Well, it's breaking news, but just in comments sections, I've been seeing people saying, yes, of course it will cost more to have more nurses.
It seems sort of intuitive.
Yeah. And the question is whether it's worth it to you. And I would just add, these issues are very complex.
Healthcare? Complex?
Yes,
who knew?
Right? Who knew? No one told us.
No one told me that.
And the members of the Health Policy Commission includes some of the most distinguished health economists in the state and the country, along with various other stakeholders. So I actually think it's a good thing that we have this independent watchdog body made up of people who can actually handle the complexity of the issues, taking a look at what this all means.
All right. So what can we actually bring so that we can actually bring some more facts to the ballot box, not just TV ads, right?
Right. Or at least good faith attempts at facts, which is sometimes all you can get when you're trying to model healthcare economics with lots of unknowns. And Anthony, this conversation is far from over. There are going to be big hearings on health costs on October 16th and 17th, so there's more to come.
All right. Carrie Goldberg is the editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Carrie, thanks so much
for coming in.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to touch down in Washington to catch up with a fast-moving story about embattled Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. An FBI investigation into allegations that he sexually assaulted Christine Blasey Ford when they were in high school is expected to wrap up this week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell expects there to be a vote to confirm him. Meanwhile, President Trump, who'd been somewhat restrained in his comments about all this, shifted tone yesterday at a political rally in Mississippi, where he mocked Blasey Ford.
I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Republican Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, all key swing votes in this nomination fight, criticized the president, Collins calling his comments just plain wrong, Murkowski calling them appalling. Joining us now from Washington is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. Sahil, good to have you. Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the president, who's been, as we mentioned, somewhat restrained about all of this. But then yesterday, he sort of returned to form. What kind of reaction has there been to this attack on Christine Blasey Ford?
Right. Well, the reaction on Capitol Hill is, as you can imagine, overall pretty negative. Democrats are very critical of his remarks. Several Republicans, as you pointed out, those three key votes, Flake, Murkowski, and Collins, are also critical of the president. But it remains unclear that that changes the calculus in any meaningful way. These senators, these Republican senators that you just mentioned, are not going to, you know, cast their votes on the basis of something the president says. They're, thinking is a lot more complicated.
Right. Well, I want to talk a little bit about Senator Jeff Flake, who was in Boston on Monday and talked about the importance of a real FBI investigation. Then yesterday at the Atlantic Festival in Washington, he raised concerns about the partisan nature of Kavanaugh's testimony last Friday. Here's a bit of what he said.
I was very troubled by the tone of the remarks. The initial defense that Judge Kavanaugh gave, I hope that I would sound that indignant if I felt that I was unjustly, you know, maligned. But then it went on, and the interaction with the members was sharp and partisan, and that concerns me. We can't have this on the court.
So interesting about that, Sahil, is when I heard Senator Flake in Boston on Monday, he was a little more restrained than that comment, which was pretty forceful, saying that we can't have this on the court. What do you hear in that comment?
Well, this has become a big part of the whole debate surrounding Kavanaugh. One of the main Democratic arguments is that his credibility came into question in that hearing and that his temperament was not very judicial. In other words, he lashed out, you know, he was angry, he was a little bit belligerent at times. He, in the words of Flake, sounded like what an innocent man would sound like if he's accused, but still, the argument is that how a judge should sound, that kind of overt partisan, attitude. So that's been a big part of the, part of the discussion that's been a huge part of the criticism coming forward, that even if he is innocent, can someone like Brett Kavanaugh be trusted to rule and to judge impartially if he's expressing these overtly partisan sentiments? And of course, the question others are asking is he going to hold a grudge as a result?
Right, right. Interesting that Flake is bringing that up. He's of course, one of the key swing votes. Last Friday, he was the one who sort of shocked the world when he pushed for a delay to allow the FBI investigation. So what do we know about the FBI investigation so far? First of all, do we know when it's expected to conclude, when we might see something about it from it? Will we see something from it?
I've heard some chatter among senators today that it could wrap up as early as today. And the report would first go to the White House, and pretty soon it would be here on Capitol Hill. It would be, according to Senate Majority Leader McConnell, available for every senator to look at privately. It won't be released to the public, however. We don't know exactly when that's going to end. The FBI has not been, speaking publicly about this investigation, as it usually doesn't, but everyone is kind of anxious to see when it comes out, and people are on guard for it to potentially land today, if not later.
Right. And Sahil, what are lawyers for Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez, who has also made allegations against Judge Kavanaugh, what are they saying about the FBI investigation so far?
They are arguing that the FBI is not conducting a thorough investigation, that it's not following up on requests from them for follow-ups and for interviews to speak with the FBI, that it hasn't, you know, pursued other leads that they consider relevant to the investigation, tried to contact other witnesses that they believe, you know, could corroborate or at least shed some more light on the allegations here. So they have said publicly that they worry the FBI's hands are being tied and that it's not conducting a thorough investigation. And those concerns have been echoed in many of Kavanaugh's critics here on Capitol Hill.
Right. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about a vote as early as this week. How soon could that come? And do we know if it'll be a straight-up floor vote, or could Republican leadership take some kind of different route here?
Well, it would have to eventually be a floor vote on the confirmation, but what McConnell has said is the full Senate will vote on the nomination this week. Now, if we want to parse that, that means it could go up until Saturday. It's not clear whether McConnell is talking about a final Senate confirmation vote or if he's talking about beginning the process, which involves a procedural vote followed by 30 hours of debate this week. So a lot of questions. Now, I will say McConnell has been very confident that Kavanaugh will be confirmed, and he has maintained that confidence. He does not have 50 votes yet. Assuming Flake is still a yes, he said he's going to support the nomination, but he wanted that FBI investigation first. Assuming he's still a yes, McConnell can only count to 49 votes right now because Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski have not yet decided. It's very likely to come down to those two. If both of them vote no, then the nomination is probably dead. If one of them votes no, the nomination could still survive if the other votes yes. So, to anyone watching the site and wants to know how it's going to come down, keep your eyes on those two.
Interesting. So I want to come back to President Trump sort of clearly doubling down on this strategy of whipping up his base, I guess, at that rally in Mississippi where he criticized Blasey Ford. He also said that it's a scary time for young men in America when you can be guilty of something that you may not be guilty of. What effect do you think all of this might have on the coming elections? What's your view on that, Sahil?
The president is trying to counter the argument that his critics and critics of Brett Kavanaugh are making, which is that there is a serious possibility that Brett Kavanaugh may be a sexual assaulter and he does not deserve to be on the Supreme Court. Now, what Trump is pointing out is that someone like Kavanaugh deserves the presumption of innocence in his view, and it could set a bad precedent for men down the line if Kavanaugh is denied, a Supreme Court seat in this case, or by kind of virtue of presuming to have been guilty. So it's counter to the whole Me Too movement, which says that women are coming forward in increasing numbers, that sexual assault is a rampant problem, and that women deserve to be heard. They deserve to be believed. He's kind of trying to flip that around and say, well, what about the young men? What about the young boys who worry that they could be falsely accused of something? The flip side to all of this is, of course, the argument here is not about Brett Kavanaugh's freedom. This is not a criminal trial where he could go to jail. This is about whether he gets a promotion. So the standard, in the views of his critics should be higher.
Yeah. Meanwhile, very quickly, I want to ask you very quickly about the New York Times story, which did this major investigation alleging, among other things, that Donald Trump's wealth was not self-made, but was the result of a huge fortune that he inherited from his dad. And probably because, according to the Times, he engaged in a series of suspect tax schemes. Now, another time in history, an allegation like this against a sitting president would be seen as a huge deal. How has the White House responded to this?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack. The Times called it outright fraud. I talked to a bunch of tax lawyers and found that, the activities that the organization engaged in to, limit the amount of estate taxes that Fred Trump would have paid, for instance, were very much outside the bounds of the law, and according to the Times reporting. And it also goes against President Trump's, argument that he is a self-made man, that his wealth was only a tiny bit of it, in his, words, was inherited, when that does not appear to be the case, according to this investigation. The White House has responded by lashing out, by attacking the Times, by attacking the press, kind of a familiar tactic that it has used in the past.
Right. Well, Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
All right. Now, the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh are at odds, to say the least. Ford says she is 100% confident she was assaulted by Kavanaugh when they were in high school. But Kavanaugh vehemently denies that it ever happened. One way to reconcile the opposing narratives is the so-called blackout theory that Kavanaugh did it, but doesn't remember because he blacked out from drinking too much. In last Friday's Senate hearing, prosecutor Rachel Mitchell brought up the possibility when she asked Kavanaugh this question.
Have you ever passed out from drinking?
Passed out would be no, but I've gone to sleep, but I've never blacked out. That's the allegation, that's wrong.
But what exactly is a blackout? What do we know about it? To answer these questions, we're joined by Dr. Richard Seitz. He's chair of Boston University's School of Public Health, Department of Community Health Sciences, and an addiction medicine specialist. And he joins us from the BU School of Public Health. Dr. Seitz, good to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here.
So can we just start with a basic definition, if one exists? What does it mean to black out, first of all?
Yeah, I mean, the question that you heard asked there was really the wrong question. It's not the same, and this is a key point, it's not the same as passing out.
Mm-hmm.
So a blackout is when there's something that you don't remember, and it happened when you were drinking, and it happens when you drink a lot very quickly, something that might happen in a drinking game when you drink 10 or 15 shots, 1.5 ounces of 80-proof liquor, something in that range, and to all around you, you appear normal or intoxicated. That is, that you're walking and talking and responding to cues in your environment and people who are with you. But later, the next day, someone asks if you remember what happened, some specific event, and you don't recall it. That's a blackout.
So what does that mean in terms of what's happening chemically in the brain, that we're walking and functioning? I mean, maybe we're stumbling around a little bit. Maybe we're slurring our words a little bit. But your point is we appear to be conscious essentially, but we don't remember a big chunk of what happened. So what's going on with the brain?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we used to believe that alcohol simply bathed the brain and had sort of a general effect on the entire brain. And that is true at very high levels. But it seems to have some specific effects on receptors and neurotransmission. And while I can't really tell you the exact neurotransmission that's involved here, what we do know is that there are parts of the brain that involved in learning and in making either short-term or longer-term memory that are affected. Mm-hmm. And what happens here is the person knows what's going on, but the experience doesn't get put into long-term memory. So they might remember it. If you're there in front of somebody and you ask them what happened just now, just 1 minute ago, they can tell you. But if you ask them the next day, it's not there because it didn't get put into the hippocampus is a part of the brain where learning happens, and it doesn't stay there for the long term.
Hmm. So do we know something about who experiences these blackouts? In other words, are some people who drink more susceptible to them than others?
We don't know a lot about who's susceptible. The scary part is that many people are susceptible, and you don't have to have an alcohol use disorder, or more commonly known as alcoholism, in order to have blackouts. You just have to drink a lot quickly, and you can have it. There are probably some genetic risks as to who's more susceptible to have them or not, but they're common enough in some samples as much as 20, 30, 40%, even as many as half of young people who drink unhealthy amounts, who drink heavily, will have reports of blackouts. So it's not rare, and so therefore, which subpopulation is more likely to get them is maybe a little bit of less interest.
Yeah. Now, Judge Brett Kavanaugh admits to drinking and liking beer as a teenager. He says he likes beer now, but he says he never passed out or he never blacked out. Is it possible that someone who has blacked out might not know it?
Yeah, in fact, it's likely that someone who blacks out doesn't know it. They can't know it unless somebody tells them something that happened.
I see.
And then they're surprised, and then they become aware, oh, really? Did I do that? Which is why, you know, one would expect that if somebody tells you that you did something when you were intoxicated, one reaction might be, gee, I'm sorry, I really didn't realize that. And many people feel quite guilty that that something might have happened when they drank heavily.
Yeah, interesting. Well, as a doctor and an addiction expert, what strikes you about the way this is being discussed in relation to these allegations against Judge Kavanaugh? What are you thinking about when you see these sort of dramatic hearings and discussions around the issue of drinking and blacking out and possibly forgetting?
Right. There's the idea that if you are intoxicated and if you forget, that somehow you might not be responsible for your actions. And I think that's a mistake. But there's also this sort of disbelief that someone could entirely forget something traumatic or something serious that might have happened. And that isn't the case. You really can forget in a blackout. The other thing that strikes me, that really struck me about the interaction is I think everybody would agree that when he was asked about his alcohol use, that he was quite annoyed at the question. Mm. He seemed angry about it and annoyed that somebody might be accusing him of drinking too much. And it turns out that one of the medical questionnaires that we use to detect alcohol use disorder, one of the questions is about if you've ever been annoyed when people ask you about or criticize your drinking. I'm not suggesting that he has an alcohol use disorder. He may or he may not. I can't diagnose that. But it is a feature, and it raises that question. I also wouldn't suggest that heavy drinking disqualifies anyone from having an important job, as many people with alcohol use disorder are fully employed and quite successful. But it raised that question for me.
Well, it's interesting, too, because if you look at this, for example, from Judge Kavanaugh's point of view, if he's absolutely convinced that he didn't do this and he had a blackout, I mean, he's sort of being asked to prove a negative. I mean, he's certain he didn't do it. If he had a blackout, he wouldn't remember it if he did. So it sort of puts him in this peculiar situation as well, if he is innocent, right?
Right. I think in that case, if he understood what a blackout was, and he understood that it could happen if you drank heavily and rapidly, then he would have to at least be open to the possibility that he did something terrible and didn't remember it.
Yeah.
And that's why I mentioned before that in that case, people who have recurrent blackouts and have a more serious condition, alcohol use disorder, often feel guilty that they may have done something. And they feel regret about it and say, gee, you know, I really don't remember it. But if I did that, I'm really sorry about it.
Right. Wow. Well, this has been really fascinating. Dr. Richard Seitz, he's chair of Boston University's School of Public Health Department of Community Health Sciences, and he's an addiction medicine specialist. Dr. Seitz, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
I was very glad to join you. Thanks.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. We're going to talk about the Red Sox playoffs coming to this fair city Friday evening. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Postseason baseball is coming back to Boston Friday night at Fenway Park. The Red Sox will begin a best-of-five series against either the New York Yankees or the Oakland Athletics, who play a one-game wild-card elimination game tonight in the Bronx. With me now to talk about that and the week in sports is Radio Boston's own Chris Siderek. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Anthony.
So, Chris, if you're a Red Sox fan, and I should say it has been alleged that I am, who do you want to be playing come Friday? Now, I have to confess, the Yankees terrify me. So maybe I'm hoping that Oakland knocks them off tonight? What do you think?
Well, first of all, I have to say I resent you questioning my fanhood. I came in with my face paint and everything. I am a Red Sox fan as well.
Okay.
And I totally get where you're coming from. It's an interesting question because this is a pretty interesting matchup. You're talking about two of potentially the best wild card teams ever.
Right.
The Yankees with 100 wins, the Oakland Athletics with 97 wins. 97 wins, that's more than any team in the National League.
It's amazing. One team with 97, the other with 100, and one of them is going to go home after one game.
One game. It's crazy. You've got to love playoff baseball.
Yeah.
So these are two teams that absolutely can hit for power. The Yankees had six guys on their roster that hit for at least 20 home runs. The Oakland Athletics had five guys who hit for at least 20 home runs.
Wow.
So you know baseball. Obviously, that means tonight's probably going to be a 1-0 pitcher's duel.
Right.
If you look at the regular season matchups, the Sox won the series against the Yankees 10-9, not exactly dominating fashion. Oakland Athletics are a really interesting case because they have been the absolute hottest team in Major League Baseball in the second half. They went 42-23 for the best record across the league. Their starting rotation is a little bit weak, but they're really built on a strong, strong bullpen and offense up and down the lineup. The Sox actually lost the series, regular season series with Oakland 2-4. I think, and I hate to say it because I have been a fan for all my life and I understand the history, I think I would rather play the Yankees.
Interesting.
Two side notes. Now, obviously, there's a little bit of a personal thing here. My dad's a Yankees fan, so that makes things a little more fun for me.
you like that inter-family warfare.
Oh, it's nothing better, right?
Right, exactly.
And ultimately, I will not be rooting for the Yankees, even though I think they're a better matchup because it's against the Red Sox religion, obviously.
Interesting. Well, I'm thinking of our old friend Bill Littlefield, who always said that he roots for the best story. And I think the best story would certainly be a Red Sox-Yankees series. Don't you think so?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, these two teams have been entwined throughout their history in maybe more than any other two teams in any sport. It's been incredible. I actually want to pick Oakland in terms of who I think will win tonight. They're playing with no pressure. Their guys are all playing above the expectations, and those teams tend to do well in the postseason because they're not thinking too much. They're just going out there and playing. But I just think the history is too much. The story is too much. I think the Yankees are going to take it home tonight in a close one. And you know when the last time the Red Sox and Yankees met in the playoffs?
2004? No.
Yeah.
2004.
2004.
Okay,
ALCS.
We know what happened there.
That's right.
All right. Okay, that means the Red Sox will lose the first two and then win three in a row.
Well, right? Let's hope it maybe doesn't play out quite that stressfully, but yeah.
Okay, so the Red Sox held a media day yesterday, and we heard from rookie manager Alex Cora, who led the team to this astonishing record, 108 wins this season. What does he have to say about this team as it heads into the playoffs?
Well, he's really focused on carrying that momentum from the regular season into the playoffs, and you know what 108 regular season wins gets you in the playoffs, right?
Right, absolutely nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So he's going to try to really keep things the same in terms of his decision making. That being said, Cora is a matchups guy, and that goes everything from pinch hitting to guys he pulls out of the bullpen to even his starting rotation. He actually said yesterday that Nathan Eovaldi will start game four most likely if they play the Yankees, but if they play the Athletics, he's not quite willing to make that commitment. So it really could kind of depend on who the hitters are, which team they're facing, and all of that. He also talked about the home field advantage, how much the team loves playing at Fenway. They hit better there. The crowd obviously helps give them energy as they go forward.
Right. Yeah. That's got to be a huge. And the Red Sox did incredibly well at Fenway Park this season.
Yeah,
too,
57
right?
and 24 on the year at
yeah.
Fenway.
So what about Chris Sale, the team's ace? He had a couple of stints on the disabled list. He didn't seem to be throwing as well when he came off the disabled list toward the end of the season. What did he say about him?
So Alex Cora said he is not at all worried, and he's 100% sure that Sale is going to be ready to go come playoff time. But
uh-huh.
I think, yeah, exactly. I think it's important to look at the context here. You're talking about he went on a DL stint. He came back for one start against Baltimore, threw 98, 99 miles an hour, and went almost immediately back on the DL with shoulder inflammation. And since coming back that second time, his velocity has really been down. Cora said that specifically in this final start against Baltimore last Wednesday, that what he saw out of Sale, actually, despite the performance and the down velocity, was pretty encouraging.
The fact that when the game was on the line in that last one and he hit 94 a few times, it wasn't 99, but he went from 88, 89 to 94. I know he's there. I know he's there. And the fact that he came to me right away, you know, after the game is over, and he felt it on the mound and he saw it on the video, I'm like, okay, you know, this is mechanics.
So whether it's mechanics or an injury, there is no doubt about the fact that Sale's velocity has been noticeably down. In that Baltimore start last week, his fastball averaged just over 90 miles an hour. That's the lowest average fastball of his entire career.
You're scaring me. All right, we got to move on to the New England Patriots for a moment or two. The Patriots quieted critics on Sunday by blowing out the Miami Dolphins 38-7. The Pats are now 2-2 on the year. How big was that win for them on Sunday?
It was actually a huge win, which is saying something for September football. I've been a Patriots fan for a long time as well. This team always kind of struggles out the gate, and by November or December, they're clicking on all cylinders. But Had they lost to Miami, they would have been down 3 games to a division opponent. That is a tough hill to climb in a 16-game season.
All right. So I've got to ask you quickly before we go about Celtic star Kyrie Irving. He made headlines last year when he said on a podcast that he believed the earth was flat. He's given different answers since then about whether he actually believed that or not, but he addressed it at the Forbes Under 30 Summit on Monday. What did he say?
Well, interesting. I bet you didn't think we'd be talking flat earth in a sports segment, but here we are. He's gone back and forth about whether or not he was initially joking. He seemed to finally admit that he did genuinely believe this when he said it at the time.
At the time, I was like huge into conspiracies. Everybody's been there. Everybody's been there like, yo, what's going on with our world? You know, like you click a YouTube click and it goes like how deep the rabbit hole goes.
He even went on to apologize to science teachers everywhere.
All right. So he's climbed out of that flat earth rabbit hole.
That's
okay.
Right.
Glad to hear. All right. That's Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Chris, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Finally tonight, we want to bring you another sample of WBUR and the Boston Globe's new investigative podcast called Last Seen. It goes deep into the unsolved mystery of the world's largest unsolved art heist at Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum almost 30 years ago. Last night on the show, we brought you the end of episode 2. We heard hosts Kelly Horan and Jack Rodolico explore the theory that the theft was an inside job. Tonight, we have the first half of episode 3, which asks the question, was the heist planned in a Dorchester auto body shop in the belly of Boston's criminal underworld?
Do you suspect the guards of collusion?
No. I don't think they're smart enough. I mean, this is big league. This isn't AAA ball down in Pawtucket. This is Fenway Park.
This is Martin Lepo, a big league criminal defense attorney with some strong opinions about the greatest art heist in history.
Let me say this way. The Gardner Museum robbery was so easy. No wonder there wasn't a tsunami of burglars coming in and do it. They have musicians guarding millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of paintings. Musicians. That's like putting Dracula in charge of a blood bank. It's so foolish and stupid that it almost invited the place to be robbed.
At 86, Lepo is still practicing. He says if there's one thing to know about him, it's that he's loyal to his wife of 51 years, to his 3 sons, even the 2 who've given him some heartache, and to the veritable rogues gallery of clients he's represented over the years. Men whose rap sheets span decades and crimes.
There's a lot. There's a lot of cases. A lot of murders, a lot of organized crime cases, a lot of disorganized crime cases.
Armed robberies, drug deals, armored car stick-up jobs, you name it. But it's the crime that gave Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum the dubious distinction of being the scene of the single largest art theft in history that seems to hold special meaning for Lepo. Framed reproductions of some of the stolen paintings hang in his law offices, including one he's especially partial to, The Concert by Vermeer.
The painting just talks to you. It's just so wonderful, magnificent. I think if you can't appreciate art, you know, from one of the great masters, what else is there?
If Lepo takes a particular interest in the Gardner heist, it isn't only because he feels the loss of what was stolen. It's also because he just might know who did it. No other defense attorney has represented more criminals who have been tied, if only unofficially, to the Gardner case. 7 in all. They are men Lepo has long defended for other crimes. And while he won't comment on what they might have known about the plan to steal some of the most valuable and beloved treasures from Isabella Stewart Gardner's collection, he will say this about whoever pulled off the robbery.
This wasn't done by a bunch of jamokes, because this was a well-organized, thing. Proof is in the pudding. They haven't found a thing.
By they, Lepo means the FBI. And he's right. In the 28 and a half years since the heist, they haven't found any of the stolen masterpieces. But one of the places the FBI has been looking at the longest reveals a lot about who they think might be behind this still unsolved crime. It's a car repair shop called TRC Auto Electric, a place hard to beat for criminals per capita. And if many of the men suspected of planning or pulling off the Gardner heist have needed Martin Lepo's services, it's because of other crimes they hatched at TRC. The question is, was the plan to rob the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum one of them? If one road to some of the suspects in the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist leads to the law offices of Martin Lepo, another leads to 1325 Dorchester Avenue in the Dorchester neighborhood of Boston. One day last summer, Kelly drove there with the Gardner Museum's head of security, Anthony Amore.
Your destination is on the left.
Wait, here?
That's it. That's TRC Auto Electric.
Really?
Yep.
In my mind, it was a much greater thing. Okay.
Picture a low-slung brick and cinder block building, much longer than it is wide, with corrugated metal doors. There's a spindly tree on the sidewalk out front, its canopy too sparse to offer shade under a withering July sun. There's everything you'd expect to find at a mechanic's, an assortment of vehicles, hoods up, three open repair bays, and spare tires and parts leaning against an exterior wall painted an industrial beige. What there isn't is any suggestion whatsoever that the former TRC Auto Electric was, in its heyday, a front for a thriving hub of criminal activity. It's only about 4 miles from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, but this place could not feel farther away.
That's true. It is a world away.
You know, you go from this Italian Renaissance palazzo that Isabella Stewart Gardner built to resemble the one she loved to stay in Venice. And here we are at a single-story brick building that's just a real different look.
But it is a great place for a crime headquarters, right? People coming and going all day, it's perfect.
Completely inauspicious, too. I mean, I would have driven right by it if I didn't have you in the car to say
right, but the
was
police
it.
Knew.
And the police knew it because the man who presided over TRC Auto Electric was an underworld powerhouse with mafia ties and a long criminal record. His name was Carmelo Merlino.
He was involved in a lot of different bank heists. He was heavily involved in cocaine dealing out of TRC. It wasn't any sort of crime he didn't have his hand in.
Carmelo Merlino was a criminal the way other people are in a religious order. He seemed called to it, and he was devoted. The same is true, Amore says, of the assorted low lives Merlino had swirling around him at TRC.
They study crime, not the history of crime. They study the newspapers and say, hey, did you hear so-and-so did such-and-such? It's the way baseball fanatics might follow the Red Sox.
One thing I've learned doing this reporting is that they also meet each other in prison.
It's crime college. And Merlino would be at Walpole, and he would have the most desirable cell. He would be in really well with the prison leadership because he was likable and people listened to him. And I don't want to say it's like that scene in Goodfellas where, you know, they go to jail and it's a big party and people are cutting up garlic for their pasta sauce, but Merlino made the best of it.
In the late 1980s, Carmelo Merlino's side hustle in car repair wasn't fooling anyone. He knew nothing about how to fix cars, but he had a real flair for turning cocaine dealt out of carburetor boxes into millions of dollars in cash. Between 1989 and 1991, a stretch of time that includes the hit on the Gardner Museum, state and local police, in conjunction with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the DEA, had TRC Auto Electric under surveillance. Robert Sekellis was a fairly new assistant attorney general for Massachusetts at the time. He recalls being part of the massive effort to make sense of it all.
We had wiretaps on TRC and Carmelo Merlino's home phone
all conversations I ever saw were all cryptic and coded. I mean, nouns were off limits with this group. They never said a name, they never said a place or anything. And we had situations where we were convinced that an important meeting was going to take place, given the discussion surrounding it, and then it turned out to be an innocuous, you know, lunch or something with an aunt. So it was very, very hard to really try to piece together what it is they were talking about. And the foot traffic in and out of there was utterly amazing. I mean, there was hundreds of people coming and going. It was a mini Grand Central Station. So trying to piece all this together and understand exactly what was happening was exceedingly difficult.
But not impossible. By 1992, Sekelis and his team had amassed enough evidence to indict Carmelo Merlino and members of his crew on cocaine trafficking charges. In response, Merlino pulled a play straight from the gangster handbook. He offered authorities a quid pro quo. Give me leniency, and I'll give you a stolen painting. Our colleague from the Boston Globe, Steve Kirkchin, says when Merlino made this offer, he also made himself a suspect in the Gardner heist. And that might have been the point.
It was a terrific feint, because I don't think, A, he knew anything about the Gardner heist at the time. And it really complicated his life. But it did absolutely get the attention of the state police and the assistant attorney generals, including Sekelis.
Now, if you're on the hook for one bad crime, why on earth would you want to raise your hand and make yourself a suspect in a worse one? Why would Merlino want to face that kind of heat?
Who wouldn't want to be Prince of the City? Find these paintings and you emerge Prince of the City. All of your sins are forgiven. You know, you come back and you have helped, you know, civilized society, the museum, in the art-loving world, young and old, to get these paintings back.
This notion, this Prince of the City ideal, offers an insight into nearly every Gardner heist suspect that we've investigated. Because, like Carmelo Merlino, each of these guys, at one point or another, shot his hand up and said, essentially, I did it, or I know who did it, or I know where the paintings are. The criminal mind is nothing if not an aspirational one. Why wouldn't you want your name attached to the greatest score of all time? Carmelo Merlino wasn't going to be crowned the prince of anything, because the painting he dangled wasn't a Rembrandt slashed from its frame at the Gardner Museum. It wasn't a Vermeer or a Manet or even a Degas sketch. It was a portrait of George Washington that had been stolen in 1985 from the Henry Wadsworth Longfellow House in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Its estimated value at the time was $5,000. Hardly the kind of bounty that doubled as a get-out-of-jail-free card. Merlino was going back to prison.
6 years later, in November 1997, Carmelo Merlino, out of prison and back at the helm at TRC Auto Electric, had a new hire at the garage, a younger guy he'd known for a long time, both in and out of prison. Unlike Carmelo Merlino, though, this guy really could fix cars. His name was Anthony Romano. He also answered to Tony.
He looked up to Carmelo, admired him, and in fact, when Anthony was in prison, he ran into Carmelo and Carmelo took care of him. Tony said, "Geez, that guy... he was respected in prison."
Retired FBI agent David Nadalski spent 21 years at the Bureau. Nadalski says Anthony Romano was not a thug, just a guy who made bad choices. He says he was a central casting image of a junkie convict, alarmingly thin, stringy hair, lots of tattoos at a time before everybody had one.
And then as parole would come up, he would get out and he would be good for a while and then he'd get back into drugs and then he'd be sticking up places again with a toy gun and he'd be back in prison. So that's basically his pattern. Never did he hurt anyone. I assess him as someone who really regretted the way things turned out for himself and he wanted to do something about it. I think he wanted to make a difference and I think he wanted to matter to somebody.
While still in prison, Anthony Romano had reached out to Nadalski at the FBI with a tip that led to the recovery of valuable manuscripts stolen from the John Quincy Adams Library in Quincy, Massachusetts. Romano had even been right about who'd stolen them.
So based on this, I determined Anthony was truthful and reliable with information. When he got out of prison, he asked to meet with me, wanted to talk about some information that had come his way concerning the Gardner theft.
This was only 6 years after the Gardner heist. People still talked about it all the time. One of those people, according to Romano, was Carmelo Merlino.
Eventually, it was clear that he was getting the impression that Carmelo Merlino, goes by the name Mello, knew where the paintings were or thought he knew where they were or and somehow or other wanted to get a hold of the paintings. Tony didn't think he was actually part of the robbery, but was working on getting the reward by finding the paintings.
That's the first half of episode 3 of Last Scene, an investigative podcast from WBUR and the Boston Globe. It features reporter Jack Rodolico and reporter and senior producer Kelly Horan from WBUR, with special contributions from Boston Globe Spotlight reporter Steve Kirkchin. To subscribe and hear the full episodes, head to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and search Last Scene. That's S-E-E-N. That's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.